One former police officer says mob violence in Montreal, this might not be, it might be as bad as it ever is going to be in the future. We'll find out what one crime expert and underworld expert thinks about that coming up this hour. Also, do we have a deal, the Canadian and Ontario government, for Stellantis to stay in Windsor? It appears there might be a deal, according to reports from the Toronto Star. And Giddy Mammon, who's an immigration lawyer, on it's a, if it's a good day or a bad day that an appeal court says that Canada is not constitutionally obligated to bring back suspected ISIS fighters. That and much more tonight on News Talk Tonight.
It's News Talk Tonight on the iHeartRadio Talk Network. Here's your host, Jim Richards.
And the evacuation of 16,492 people from their homes, some of whom have no home to return to.
That's Mike Savage. He's the mayor of Halifax. Of course, there are forest fires all around.
There's something else that people can do to support this cause. Don't burn. I want to put a new twist on an old favorite from a previous crisis. No blazes at home. We're serious about this. We're taking calls for open burning since last evening. 8 calls. Stop doing that. Think about other people. Don't be selfish. Don't be stupid.
It's kind of crazy to think that is still going on the face of people losing their homes. Like one young woman who was on today with Vashi Kapelos. She talked about living with her boyfriend and her family in her childhood home, a childhood home that she was about to inherit.
As we headed towards our house, it truly felt like a scene from an apocalyptic movie. There was ash everywhere falling from the sky. When you got out of the car, you could feel the heat from wherever the flames were, but we couldn't see those at the time. We gathered as much as we could, realizing that it was really serious, a lot more than we had thought.
And you just look around, and every single one of your memories, they come with you, but sometimes memories are associated with buildings and where you had them.
It's very hard to think about a home that you grew up in and all the memories that you have there. And being in an unfamiliar place, I think when people go through grief, or at least what I feel is, I want to go home. And when you realize you don't have a home to go to, that's a really awful feeling. And yeah, you feel lost.
We thought we would reach out to somebody who lives in the Halifax area. Sean King has had to evacuate. You might remember him. Sean, was it 2014 you were on Amazing Race?
2014, yeah.
Yeah. And you now currently live in the Halifax area. Whereabouts do you live?
We live in Hammonds Plains, yeah, just outside the downtown area.
Okay, so can you paint the picture of where the fires are for people who are not from that area or familiar with the area and where you are?
Yeah, so we were, I guess, east of the fires, which were outside the city towards Upper Tantallon. So, again, we're about, you know, in traffic 30 to 45 minutes outside of downtown Halifax. And the fires were sort of towards St. Margaret's Bay, which would be, I guess, west of us. And we would be about a 10-minute drive from where that started.
Yeah. And how long ago were you evacuated?
So that was Sunday afternoon. We were sitting. It was a beautiful, hot day. We were sitting down, literally having our first glass of what would have been, I'm sure, a few glasses of rosé. I was on a phone call with my brother, who's in Toronto, a FaceTime video, and we could see the smoke. And we hadn't heard anything about fires, so we could just see smoke. And then my wife started to get updates on her phone. And at first, I mean, I thought it was not funny, but I was certainly making light of it. Mm. I was, you know, turning the camera around to show my brother the smoke. And then I could feel, you know, my wife's energy was changing, the pacing had started. And I thought, you know, I better go. And our first question was, you know, should we pack something just in case? And we went from that question, should we pack something, to, I mean, close to panic, running around the house, trying to decide what to do in about 20 minutes.
So it was 20 minutes from you seeing smoke in the distance in your backyard to, hey, we got to get a Winnebago and get the hell out of here or something like that.
Yeah, we got to get out of here. Like, and the issue for us was it's a really congested area. There's only kind of one or two ways in and out of that neighborhood. It's a bit of a problem in that area. And our thinking was, let's go now. Let's not wait. Let's get out before traffic picks up or we're going to be in real trouble. It was too late. By the time we had packed our car, we packed both vehicles, packed our cat, photo albums. It's a really strange thing to walk around your house and decide what you should take.
Mm.
And by the time we had got out to the road, the traffic was at a complete standstill.
And was this all based on you seeing the fire in the distance? Or because we haven't mentioned, hey, we checked in with local authorities and all that kind of stuff. But I'm guessing you were doing that. You saw the fire and you're like turning on the radio or turning on the TV to find out what's going on.
Well, our phone started ringing. We started getting texts and phone calls from people wondering if we were okay, and we really had no idea that this was even happening. And so then we started to understand what was going on, and like it was crazy, man. Like literally went from, look, should we pack a bag? And you know, I was in denial. I'm like, no, we're going to be fine. To running around the house trying to decide what to put in the suitcases before we hopped in the car.
Yeah,
yeah. And I'll tell you, I mean,
what is that like? What is that like?
It's weird. You know, we were running around the house. I remember standing in the closet. You know, I travel a lot for work. It's not an unusual thing to pack a suitcase for travel. But I stood in front of the closet and literally was like, I don't know what to grab. I have no idea what to put in this suitcase. So I just grabbed a handful of things and stuffed them in, you know, socks, underwear, that kind of stuff. My wife grabbed passports and identification, you know, will documents, pet stuff. I think that was the first load. And then, you know, we felt like we had time. So I went back in and we took photo albums and stuff that, you know, we only had one of. And then I finished by grabbing guitars. I packed up all my guitars and put them in the car.
Mm.
And away we went.
And that was 4 or 5 days ago? That was on...
That was Sunday afternoon, yeah.
That was Sunday afternoon.
Yeah.
And what has happened to your neighborhood since that time?
Well, so far as we can tell, our neighborhood specifically is still okay. The fire is continuing to creep. It was coming towards us, I think, Monday into Tuesday before they started to sort of, I guess, they haven't controlled it yet. That's what we're hearing. But they've been able to, I guess, keep it contained to an area.
Mm.
I don't know if that's somehow different. But yesterday, you know, multiple new fires had started. In various locations. There was a new one today that popped up. I mean, it's a state of emergency here. It's really unusual. It feels surreal. I'll tell you, I was stuck in traffic waiting to get out of the neighborhood and the smoke was billowing and there was, there's a stables, on the same street. And so the people that had horses were trying to walk the horses away from the stables and get them into a field. And it felt like a movie. I mean, everyone has stopped. I was talking to the guy. I said, you know, maybe I should go this way. And he looked at me and he said, you know, I don't think you're going to get out of here.
Mm.
Now, I don't know about you, but someone says something like that to you in a situation like this, when I was already afraid of that, it did not feel real. It was hard to believe it was actually happening. And,
yeah.
You know, we're lucky so far.
So what has, and I know it may be, hopefully you'll be able to get back in your house and your house will be fine. But what has it been like feeling kind of hopeless for the last 3 days, not having any control over what happens?
It's hopeless is the best way to describe it. It's unnerving for sure. There's a whole range of emotions, you know, frankly, that I've never felt before. It's an interesting thing to be in need and to have to rely on others. And, you know, when you do that, there's this guilt of being a burden that is new. There's you want to be comfortable, but it's hard to relax. You know, we've become obsessed with watching updates and making sure people are okay. You know, constantly answering questions from people who are calling us and reaching out. I mean, the support, frankly, has been unbelievable. But it's also heartbreaking. You know, it's very emotional. I would say up until today, we were pretty good. This morning was a bit rough. You know, I think we both had a little episode of, you know, wondering if we were going to get back. And you don't know how long you're going to be out. So it's an incredibly strange feeling.
And sitting back, and as you said, feeling hopeless, how do you feel about how it's been handled?
You know, I don't think that I can give enough credit to the folks that are, you know, the people that are managing this and having to deal with it. from what we understand, the support's been coming in from multiple provinces, multiple regions. You know, the updates on the TV are every few hours now. You can tell that they care. And from what I understand, it's going quite well. So, you know, when all the dust settles on this, you know, it'll be an amazing feeling to be able to thank those people for what they're doing. But it's been quite amazing, actually, to witness.
That's Sean King. He's out in the Halifax area with his family. And we wish everybody in Nova Scotia who are battling those fires the best of luck. One Montreal former police officer says bikers, Italians, and Irish are going to look like altar boys compared to the guys coming into the Montreal area. We'll ask one expert on the underworld about that next here on the iHeartTalk Radio Network.
Welcome back to News Talk Tonight with Jim Richards on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
What's going on in the underworld? A former Montreal police officer says bikers, Italians, and the Irish are going to look like altar boys compared to the guys coming in. We'll ask an expert when it comes to the Canadian underworld, a man who has written a gazillion books about bikers and mafia, that coming up in about 15 minutes time over the iHeart Radio Talk Network. I was a little shocked to see this headline earlier today. And the headline says that a federal court of appeal, Canada not constitutionally obligated to bring home suspected ISIS fighters. This, as we've constantly heard since the time of Omar Khadr and maybe before that, that the Canadian government is obliged to act on behalf of Canadian citizens who might be arrested abroad. That's what we heard was going on with Omar Khadr. But it's interesting that this government that did give Omar Khadr $10 million is now the government that is fighting bringing home these people who are suspected, underline suspected, ISIS fighters. So have they even had their day in court? Migrationlaw.com. Migrationlaw.com is where you'll find immigration lawyer Giddy Mammon, and he joins us right now. Giddy, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
All right. Are you shocked at this ruling?
No, not really. Listen, it all turns on one of the rights in our Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which says that every citizen of Canada has the right to enter, remain, and leave Canada. A very simple concept. If you're a Canadian citizen, you can go, you can come, you can stay, and if you leave, you can return. No problem. What the litigants here tried to do was to establish some sort of constitutional right to be returned to Canada. And that's where the court just wouldn't have it. Interestingly enough, at the trial division in the federal court, it was allowed. The application was allowed, but it was overturned at the federal court of appeal in a unanimous decision of three judges.
And you think that makes... I'm asking, I don't have an opinion necessarily. I was kind of shocked because I thought, you know, we were told all along that, hey, you have to advocate for Canadians and you have to be let... Well, have to be let back in might be a little strong, but I always thought that, okay, these guys are going to return. It doesn't mean that we have to think that they're good people, that they would have their day in court here. They would come back to Canada and that they'd be in jail for, I don't know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years.
So Canada has definitely stuck its neck out to help Canadians who are in distress. So, for example, in July of 2006, there was about 15,000 Canadian citizens in Lebanon when Hezbollah attacked Israel and a war broke out. So we sent ships and we got these people out and, you know, that was fine. Also in Sudan, we rescued not too long ago Canadians who were stuck in Sudan. And,
yep.
And as you said, Omar Khadr as well. But these are different situations. First of all, Canada certainly can rescue anybody that they want, Canadians or non-Canadians. But the question is, do they have an obligation? And in this situation, in 2011, the government of Canada issued a warning to everybody, do not go to Syria. Just stay away from there. They told people to stay away and that if they went in and they got into trouble, Canada would not help. So these individuals went anyways. And now to get them out, we're going to have to send some Canadian representatives into what is admittedly a war zone with great personal risk to get them out. And the court has said, listen, we encourage the Canadian government to help its citizens abroad if they want, but there is no constitutional right that requires a Canadian representative to go into a war zone to extract Canadians who are warned not to go and warned that they will not be rescued if they go because it will be an impossible task to get them out without risk to other Canadians. So that's the situation, and I think the court was correct in that decision. Mm-hmm. The right to return to Canada doesn't mean that the government of Canada has an obligation to send people to a war zone to get you out after you've been warned not to go there.
Okay, so these people are suspected to be fighting on behalf of ISIS. The women who went over, I guess, for wanted to help feed or be companions or whatever reason they might have gone over, why is it viewed differently?
Well, it's a question of constitutional interpretation and international law. We don't subscribe in Canada, either in the charter or via international law, that a government has a duty to rescue someone who's put themselves in a very dangerous situation. Of course, we have the obligation with our Foreign Affairs Department to offer passport assistance and visa and consular assistance, you know, if you're charged with a crime, to try to help you get counsel and stuff. But it is a very different thing to say Canada has an obligation to go into a dangerous place where you put yourself into and get you out. The charter protects, it grants us rights. We can leave, we can stay, and we can go. But it doesn't say that the government has to go bring you back wherever you go and at whatever risk.
Okay, so a lot of people listening right now will not differentiate because he was 15 going on 16, and there's no way that they would see the difference between Omar Khadr and this. Is there a difference? And if so, what is the difference?
Well, the court spoke very clearly on that situation. It said that Canada could have a responsibility outside of the charter, but it could have a responsibility to bring you back if it was somehow complicit in the danger that you're in. And in the situation of Omar Khadr, in 2010, the Supreme Court of Canada found that the Canadian government, by sending intelligence officers to interrogate him, Canadian intelligence officers to interrogate him, and then to turn that information over to the U.S., contributed to his dilemma. So we had, by that reason, an obligation to rescue him and extract him from that situation. Also, as you mentioned, he was a child. So he was a particularly vulnerable person, and we made his situation significantly worse. So that's why the Supreme Court found that Canada was liable and ordered a $10 million reward to him. And so, that's the difference.
Okay, so this is the Court of Appeal in Canada. Is it appealable?
Of course, it could go to the Supreme Court of Canada. The decision was a unanimous decision, three judges. The decision seems very well reasoned, and it seems to be consistent with international law.
Yeah.
And the charter has to be read very narrowly. It has to be read with the intention of the authors of the charter. And this was not designed to say, hey, Canada, you have an obligation to rescue people. This was intended to tell Canadian citizens, hey, you can enter the country, you can stay, and you can leave, and you can return at any time.
Would we ever be obliged to take them back? That is to say, if they're kicked out of the country that they're in and have nowhere else to go, or do they just have to figure that out on their own, hoping that some country would sympathize with them? Or at a certain point, would Canada be forced to take them back?
Well, if they were outside of that situation and they presented themselves at a Canadian consulate or a Canadian embassy, for sure the Canadian consular officials are going to be required to give them assistance, consular assistance. They would have to satisfy themselves that they are Canadian citizens, who they are, mm-hmm. and they would be required to issue them documents, travel documents. You know, if they got in trouble with the law, maybe some help with counsel or something like that. That we can expect, that's for sure. But beyond that, it's not a constitutional guarantee.
All right. Giddy Mammon, thank you very much. Migrationlaw.com. I'm Jim Richards. This is News Talk Tonight.
The reason auto manufacturers are taking AM radios out of cars. Jim Richards and News Talk Tonight on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
All right. We're going to talk to one of the editors of Automotive News in Canada on reports from The Star that it looks like the province, Stellantis, and the federal government have a deal. That in about 15 minutes' time. I am Jim Richards. This is the iHeart Talk Radio Network. I was perusing the Montreal Gazette earlier today, and our friend Aaron Rand from CJD, he has got a podcast that is called, with a couple of his friends, called The Corner Booth, and they film it at a restaurant. They had one guest who is a former police officer in Montreal. His name is Pedro Paletti, and he said some interesting things about what is going on in Montreal right now with the underworld, and I thought we would focus on some of those and talk to somebody who is a bit of an expert in Canada when it comes to the underworld. He's written books about the mafia, bikers, and I could go on and on and on. One of the things that the former police officer said that I was very shocked at is the number of deaths over the years in Montreal related to organized crime.
One must remember that since 1970 till today, we had over 400 homicides related to organized crime, directly related.
So let's go back to 2004, and that is when one of the crime bosses, Vito Rizzuto, was arrested.
2004, Vito Rizzuto was arrested. And I remember him telling me during his transport following the arrest, he says, when I leave, it's going to be mayhem, it's crazy. He was absolutely right.
Right.
And his famous, you know, he says, if I have 200 men, 199 of them wanted me to leave the bus. So that's exactly what happened. The cab left, the mice were dancing.
One of the interesting things that I thought he said was that that there is no kind of honor among people in the underworld any longer. It's a bunch of people making up rules as they go along. But this is what I thought was the interesting thing that he brought up.
The new mafias. We're going to have new mafias here in Montreal. We have the MS-13, the Mexicans. We have the Colombians. We have the Arab-based. So we're going to have our hands full. And you'll mark my words, in 5, 6 years, 7 years, bikers and Italians and Irish will look like altar boys compared to these individuals that are coming in.
Wow.
If the authorities don't put their foot down.
And that is from the podcast, The Corner Booth. It features CJD's Aaron Rand. Peter Edwards joins us right now. He works with the Toronto Star, but has investigated things in organized crime right across this country. And I don't know if there is a better expert when it comes to this sort of thing. Peter, thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Because we got to go back, what was it, a couple of weeks, where we saw the wife of one of the members of a crime family killed at her business, correct?
Yes, a woman named Claudia Iacono, she was shot. She's the daughter-in-law of the big mob guy.
Okay. What did you think of what this former police officer, Officer Paletti, said in that the landscape is changing so quickly, and that the people who are coming into this country specifically, what makes Montreal different than a lot of the other cities in the country before we go anywhere?
I think it's a pretty tough church he goes to. These are the altar boys right off the start. Montreal is really close to New York City, and it's a port city, so it's not that long of a drive if you get the drugs to bring them down there. Ports make it very, very easy to bring things in. So it's always had that going for it, crime-wise.
Do you agree with Mr. Paletti when he says that the Irish and the bikers and the Italians aren't anything compared to what might be a new wave of organized crime with people from all sorts of different countries?
I've been talking a lot to a guy from a gang called the United Nations, and that's a very, very multi-ethnic gang that's quite... rooted in Canada right now, and he said this has been going on for a while. Like, this isn't the future. This is 10 years ago. But the cartel guys, the people who, the suppliers, they're in the country, but they just watch and sell. They want the Canadians to do the distribution. They just keep an eye on things. And so this has been going way back. I covered something 30-something years ago where cartel guys killed a lawyer in Montreal. So this isn't the future. This is already going on now. And they're not the boots on the ground soldiers doing the nasty things. They're the smart guys like ambassadors deciding how much should be sold to who for what price. They don't want any one group to rise up, and so they'll sell it to one group and their competition, and they'll adjust the prices so that neither one of them rises too high.
Why don't they want one group to rise too high?
Because with the mafia, what happened was the Hells Angels rose up and then they became competition. You want to keep them fighting so that they never hit your level.
Okay. What makes up this group called the United Nations?
Pretty much every kind of group. I mean, there's a guy just got extradited from Canada on the weekend to Bangkok. They're a very, very, and that was for a hit there. And so it's a very, very multi-ethnic gang. And the members can be, it started in Surrey, BC, but it's all across Canada. And they can be anywhere in the world. Like with the internet, it really doesn't matter where you are physically.
And with these guys, are there turf wars with traditional organized crime, as mentioned, you know, bikers and the mafia?
A lot of it's working around them or working with them. I mean, the smart ones, the ones who've been around for a while, and it's odd because some of the wise old men are like 36-year-olds. So it's not like the mafia where you wait till you're 70 to get the top job. But there's a lot of working with them, and the smart ones want to make money. Whenever there's a war, like in BC, there was a huge war. The money earning just ground right down in Quebec, the biker wars, that really hurt money. So wars are bad for business.
If you were in law enforcement after the killing of the wife of the member of the crime family in Montreal, what would you be looking for, and what would you be afraid of breaking out next?
I'd be running around to a bunch of their ex-wives, playing them tapes and getting them jumpy and finding out what they know. I know in BC that there's a lot of targeting of women who would know things, getting them to talk. The idea that a woman was shot isn't that novel, though. And I was talking to someone on the weekend who said that he listed 8 or 10 women who've been killed. It's not right out of the blue.
How often do you see perhaps ex-wives of some of these guys talking? I mean, wouldn't they fear for their life?
You don't have to publicly talk. I mean, you can talk in the background. You can direct someone. I covered something recently where there was a big alimony dispute, and a woman's trying to point authorities to where to get her ex's money. People talk, and it's pretty easy to be discreet now. With the internet, you can feed information without being seen walking in a door.
Peter, are you working on anything right now?
Yeah, I'm doing a lot with this guy who had been from the United Nations, so I'm talking to him 2, 3, 4 times a week now.
And what are they involved in?
I mean, in the end, it comes down to cocaine. Like,
yep.
There are all these other things where money gets pumped into tow trucks, it gets pumped into things like sports memorabilia, it gets pumped into construction, but the engine of everything really is the cocaine trade, and then a little bit of chemical drugs. There's a little bit manufacturing, but it's mostly just bringing in lots of cocaine.
And United Nations is in every major city, or where are they usually situated?
Starting in Surrey, but they popped up across the country, and they've been fighting with a group called the Wolfpack Alliance, and they were in Montreal, they were in Toronto, they're around BC. One of them, a couple were murdered in Mexico. There's the top one just broke out of prison last summer, and my guess is he's somewhere in the Mideast right now, but it really doesn't matter.
Wow. Peter, thank you very much. Always a fascinating conversation. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
If there is a book that has been written about the underworld or organized crime, mafia, bikers, it's been written by Peter Edwards in this country. We thank him for his time. Is there a deal that we'll hear about in the next couple of days about Ontario, Canada, and Stellantis? That's next on the iHeartTalk Radio Network.
News Talk Tonight is on with your host, Jim Richards, on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
We have covered quite extensively the story that a lot of people in Windsor are concerned about. In fact, Canada might be concerned in terms of, and I know there are electric cars right now, and it's hard to say that we're still at the bottom step and getting our foot in the door, and that these two things that are going on right now in the Windsor area for A, Volkswagen and Stellantis. We thought we had that Stellantis deal making the cells and the modules, but what we're hearing now that there could be a deal between the French parent company of Chrysler, Jeep, and Fiat and the Canadian taxpayers. It's essentially what it is. That would make it that deal a little closer to what the Canadian government and provincial Ontario government gave Volkswagen. So the headline, and again, this is Toronto Star reporting, that Justin Trudeau and Doug Ford have reached a tentative deal worth billions more to save Stellantis and their battery plants. Again, there's a cell plant and a module plant. We talked to Greg Layson earlier this week. He is the digital and mobile editor of Automotive News Canada, and he joins us right now. Greg, thank you very much for your time.
Anytime.
All right. So what are you hearing about some of the about what the Toronto Star is reporting?
You know, I started to hear rumblings earlier this morning that a deal might be close. I had heard earlier this week, I think I told you the last time we spoke, that Stellantis maybe didn't want as much money and incentives to close the deal, but they wanted more than was initially offered. And I think that's what you're going to see when all the dust settles. I don't know how transparent everything will be. You know, we've heard Doug Ford and the Liberals talk about protecting the details because they're competitive in nature, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact of the matter is, we all know how much the Volkswagen deal is worth, and it all includes Stellantis, and they wanted something similar, and it sounds like that's what they're going to get.
So if this, and again, this is the Toronto Star, and one of our main contributors that you might hear on Vasya Capello's show, or on the More in the Morning show on in Toronto, Robert Benzies is doing some reporting along with Tonda Charles in the Toronto Star. And the headline again is that Justin Trudeau and Doug Ford reached tentative deal worth billions more to save Stellantis and the battery plants. So you're not hearing of an intimate announcement or Justin Trudeau and Doug Ford showing up in Windsor in the next couple of days. These are just, I'm not saying that they're rumors, but this is just early reporting.
This is early reporting by folks that cover the government more than they cover the auto industry, I would say. So I'm sure they're hearing it from their government sources. The auto industry is pretty tight-lipped. I don't have an easy time getting information out of Stellantis. It's not as easy as it is getting it out of politicians sometimes, but I suspected we would have a deal by the end of this week. And I think you look at the GM deal in Quebec announced yesterday or 2 days ago now that the federal and Quebec government were going to kick in $300 million for a battery materials plant in Quebec, and that's a $600 million project. The same team that worked on that deal is working on the Stellantis deal. So I think once that was cleared from the books and from the table, that same federal team could then finalize everything with Stellantis, probably within the next couple of days.
And what was your reporting earlier in the week when you were saying that Stellantis looked like they were pulling back a little bit in their expectations, but they still wanted more antied in?
So the production at St. Thomas for Volkswagen and the production for Stellantis in Windsor are slightly different. Stellantis will make modules, Volkswagen will not. And those modules get an incentive under the U.S. Inflation Reduction Act. And that is what Stellantis was pursuing. They wanted the incentive for those as well. And it was $10 a kilowatt hour, which in lay terms is if you make more modules for a longer period of time, over a decade versus 5 years or whatever the case may be, you will get more incentive money, because the longer you keep churning them out, the more you keep getting that $10 credit. And that's what Stellantis wanted. And I've heard from a couple sources that they were willing to accept maybe $5 an hour, cut that in half. Because part of the problem is Stellantis didn't really have anywhere else to go. They were just trying to squeeze a little bit more money out of the federal government. If they got nothing, they could probably move the module work somewhere else. If they got $5, a little less than what they wanted, it became worth it to stay in Windsor. And I think that's what we're going to see.
And explain to people again why Windsor is such a great idea, just because of where it's situated.
So Windsor, right across from Detroit, essentially across from the North American headquarters of Stellantis. But Windsor has the Windsor Assembly Plant, which is going to be building new electrified product beginning in about 2024. And those batteries for those vehicles will come from this battery plant. Brampton also expected to be retooled and also build electrified product and use the batteries that are made in Windsor. If the battery plant didn't happen, products in both those plants were in jeopardy, more so in Brampton than in Windsor, because they would do the packaging of the cells into those modules in Michigan and then send them to factories in the States rather than back up the 401, which means crossing the border to Brampton. So Brampton was really the one that was in trouble, and everyone kind of glazed over it and wasn't really paying attention. But I think the Liberals wanted to get this job done because Brampton is surrounded by about 9 Liberal ridings. That would have been a huge loss for them and tough to explain to a bunch of Liberal voters if the battery plant in Windsor went away and it meant product in Brampton also died.
Well, let's hope we hear something in the next couple of days. Greg, thank you very much for your time.
Anytime.
Greg Lason is the digital and mobile editor for Automotive News Canada, and he's got his eye on that. Again, it's the Toronto Star's reporting through work in Ottawa done by Tonda McCharles, and in Toronto at Queen's Park done by Robert Benzies. The headline again is Justin Trudeau and Doug Ford reach tentative deal worth billions more to save Stellantis electric car vehicle battery plant. Okay, in moments, our friend Dan Riskin is here for Nerd News, and then we have Ask a Blank Anything. Today on Ask Anything, we're going to be doing someone who actually helps, I don't want to say rescue as in take them in and get them adopted, but helps wild animals be, visit the vet and then be reintegrated into the wild, which I think is a pretty neat job. That is coming up in about 35 minutes here on the iHeart Talk Radio Network. And I still want to, at one point, have an opportunity to talk about and get your thoughts on, because I just wonder who is judging Al Pacino right now with the news that he is having a child. He is 83? I know he's 54 years older then the woman is going to be bearing his child, who is 29, who has also apparently been rumored to have relationships with Mick Jagger. And I've read that she dated Clint Eastwood, and I read that they were just platonic friends. But I know a lot of people have some judgy things to say. Talk about that with Advice Lady a little bit later on as well. I'm Jim Richards, the iHeart Talk Radio Network.